Today is Wednesday, January 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. government remains in partial shutdown over a border wall as the president and Democrats make their case.
There is evidence, at least circumstantially, to suggest that actually all immigrants have done to the U.S. economy is make it expand and create new opportunities for wealth.
Italy is facing its own migration crisis. The leaders of North Korea and China hold meetings, but the reason is unclear. Also ahead, a rare Grammy nomination for a woman. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump made a televised plea for border wall funding Tuesday night, seeking an edge in the shutdown battle with congressional Democrats as he declared there is a, quote, humanitarian crisis, a crisis of the heart, and a crisis of the soul. Addressing the nation from the Oval Office for the first time, Trump argued for funding on security and humanitarian grounds as he sought to put pressure on newly empowered Democrats amid an extended partial government shutdown.
Every day, Customs and Border Patrol agents encounter thousands of illegal immigrants trying to enter our country. We are out of space to hold them, and we have no way to promptly return them back home to their country. America proudly welcomes millions of lawful immigrants who enrich our society and contribute to our nation. But all Americans are hurt by uncontrolled illegal migration. It strains public resources and drives down jobs and wages. Among those hardest hit are African Americans and Hispanic Americans. Our southern border is a pipeline for vast quantities of illegal drugs, including meth, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl. Every week, 300 of our citizens are killed by heroin alone, 90% of which floods across from our southern border. More Americans will die from drugs this year than were killed in the entire Vietnam War. In the last 2 years, ICE officers made 266,000 arrests of aliens with criminal records, including those charged or convicted of 100,000 assaults, 30,000 sex crimes, and 4,000 violent killings.
Well, Trump called on Democrats to return to the White House to meet with him, saying it was immoral for politicians to do nothing. Trump, who has long railed against illegal immigration at the border, has recently seized on humanitarian concerns to argue there's a border crisis that can only be solved with a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. But critics say the security risks are overblown and his administration is at least partly to blame for the humanitarian situation. Democrats have vowed to block funding for a wall, which they say would be immoral and ineffective, and have called on Trump to reopen shuttered portions of the government while border negotiations continue. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Tuesday night in a rebuttal of President Trump's Oval Office address that he must stop holding the American people hostage, stop manufacturing a crisis, and reopen the government.
Much of what we heard from President Trump throughout this sense of shutdown has been full of misinformation and even malice. The president has chosen fear. We want to start with the facts. The fact is, on the very first day of this Congress, House Democrats passed Senate Republican legislation to reopen government and fund smart, effective border security solutions. But the president is rejecting these bipartisan bills, which would reopen government, over his obsession with forcing American taxpayers to waste billions of dollars on an expensive and ineffective wall, a wall he always promised Mexico would pay for. The fact is, President Trump has chosen to hold hostage critical services for the health, safety, and well-being of the American people and withhold the paychecks of 800,000 innocent workers across the nation, many of them veterans. He promised to keep government shut down for months or years, no matter whom it hurts. That's just plain wrong. The fact is, we all agree we need to secure our borders while honoring our values. We can build the infrastructure and roads at our ports of entry. We can install new technology to scan cars and trucks for drugs coming into our nation. We can hire the personnel we need to facilitate trade and immigration at the border. we can fund more innovation to detect unauthorized crossings. The fact is, the women and children at the border are not a security threat. They are a humanitarian challenge, a challenge that President Trump's own cruel and counterproductive policies have only deepened. And the fact is, President Trump must stop holding the American people hostage, must stop manufacturing a crisis, and must reopen the government.
Well, Trump has been discussing the idea of declaring a national emergency to allow him to circumvent Congress and move forward with the wall, but he made no mention of such a declaration Tuesday night. Here to discuss more about the immigration issues facing the United States is Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government, and the author of the book, The New Minority: White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Equality. Justin, how big of a crisis do we have on the U.S. border with Mexico?
To the extent that there is any crisis right now, it is a humanitarian crisis rather than a border control crisis. A border control crisis would be if immigrants were flowing into the country without authorization, if there was a sort of mass violation of visa terms leading to a lot of deportable undocumented immigrants. The numbers of people entering the country without authorization and violating the terms of their visas is no higher today than it has been. And if anything, it's been largely a downward slope over the last 20 years, lower and lower and lower. The crisis is one of families being separated. The crisis is one of people being denied their right to an asylum trial and to consideration of an asylum claim. The crisis is in the politicization of what is normally a very orderly process of admission or decline at the U.S. border. That is the principal crisis that we have today.
So you're saying a wall is not the answer to the problems that we face, despite the fact that this is the issue at hand as to why the U.S. government is in partial shutdown?
A wall would be necessary if you are looking to secure a border that is otherwise being violated grossly and without any possibility of actually containing people on the other side. That is not what's happening on the southern border of the United States today. And really, it's not anything that's been happening at the U.S. southern border for the last decade. So build the wall for the Trump administration is derived, obviously, from the Trump campaign. Very few conventional politicians would allow a slogan to basically dictate policy and shut down a government and change people's lives and possibly even affect regional economies in many places.
We've heard a lot from the Trump administration about terrorists and the danger and terrorists coming through our southern border to try to make the case that we need this wall. But it sounds like they're talking about thousands and there's really literally only been a handful of cases of something like this. Do you agree?
So this was actually discussed directly with administration officials last Sunday on Fox News, where Chris Wallace actually did the research, and his show did the research, to show that of the 4,000 terrorism suspects that have been apprehended at the U.S. border, almost all of them were apprehended at airports. Airports also constitute an American border because they're where foreigners enter the United States. That is not where a wall would go, and that is not where the presumable border crisis is taking place right now. So to be discussing the wall as some sort of resolution to terrorism is not just nonsensical, it's really a misrepresentation of the circumstances that face the United States right now.
We've also heard about many of these people coming into the country who have already had a criminal record in the U.S., but my understanding is many of those people that have criminal records are really just because they've been deported and that's on their record, that they've been deported and reenter.
Yeah, I don't think that the American government has great intelligence, great data on prospective immigrants. I study prospective immigrants as part of my research, and I can tell you that it's very difficult to really understand who is attempting to enter and what are their demographic and even criminal characteristics. The reason why is that we just don't know what people's intentions are, and until they have been documented by government or other institutions, we don't even know that they exist. So unless the government has been doing surveys of people who have an intention of migrating to the United States, then this is really just speculation about who they are and what records they may have. If they were to have a record of previously being deported from the United States, it's important to recognize that that breaking of the law is an administrative violation. It is a violation of paperwork. It's not actually a criminal act, and it's not even a civil crime. It's an administrative crime. And so the idea that they pose a danger to the United States because of this administrative crime does not make sense either. Now, you can certainly consider that as, you know, a part of a criminal record, but I don't think it's worth any way calling them dangerous unless they actually have perpetrated a physical crime in their past. It's very clear is that actually a minority of the undocumented immigrants of the United States crossed the border illegally. The majority entered legally, entered with authorization, but subsequently violated the terms of their visa. And that means that they worked perhaps when they weren't supposed to work, or that they overstayed a visa that was time limited.
All right. That's Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The question of protocol, U.S. clashes with the EU over a diplomatic status of delegation. The Pentagon denies reports the U.S. military witnessed prisoner torture in Yemen. A Russian lawyer at the heart of the Trump Tower meeting has been indicted. And a Burundi cosmetics line can prevent malaria. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The European Union issued a statement today calling for countries to unite and to allow the rescue of migrant ships Sea-Watch and Sea-Eye to dock at a safe port. The vessels have been stranded at sea for over 2 weeks, with a total of 49 migrants on board the ships. In addition, 18 charities also are calling for urgent action to bring the migrants to safety. Meanwhile, Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini is fighting with two local mayors who say Italy should accept the migrants, despite a government ban on doing so. VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome about the latest migrant developments.
Margherita Schinas, the spokeswoman for the European Commission, which is the executive body of the EU, said today that the European Union is urging countries to show their concrete solidarity and allow the 49 migrants trapped on these two humanitarian ships to disembark at a safe port without delay. Now, she said that several member states had expressed their willingness to contribute to this common effort, but so far there's been no real indication of any country that would come forward to accept the migrants. Germany has indicated some interest in taking some of the migrants, and the Italian government seems quite divided about what to do. Some indications from Deputy Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio saying that women and children should be allowed to disembark, but so far there hasn't been a coordinated response from these countries to come together and work out precisely where these migrants might be able to disembark at a safe port.
Do we have any word on the condition of the migrants?
Well, yesterday there were reports that some of the migrants were refusing to eat. Now there's been a statement today on Twitter from Sea-Watch saying that despite a tense situation on board after 18 days for some of these migrants, that everybody was eating again, and stressed that once again that they were waiting for a solution from the EU. Last week, 24 humanitarian groups, including Amnesty International, Save the Children, and the United Nations International Organization for Migration, called on the European Union to offer a safe port to both these vessels.
What is the Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini? What is the situation with him and some local mayors?
Well, we've seen divisions emerging between the Italian government and mayors, the mayor of Palermo and the mayor of Naples, in particular, calling for a kinder approach, willing to welcome some of these migrants. But we've also seen divisions emerging between the two deputy prime ministers, Matteo Salvini and the other deputy prime minister, Luigi Di Maio, from the Five Star Movement, a little bit more to the left, suggesting that there should be a softer approach and with Mr. De Maio saying that women and children should be protected and should be welcomed. So we're seeing divisions there. We're also seeing a bitter diplomatic standoff between Italy and Malta. Malta saying that it wasn't that country's responsibility. Malta has allowed these NGO rescue ships to shelter from the bad weather, has allowed them to top up their supplies, but still refusing to allow the migrants to disembark in Malta. So we seem to be going around in circles here. And Matteo Salvini, the Interior Minister, has kept up his very hard line, saying Italian ports are closed to human traffickers, and if we give in, the traffickers will start making money again, and the NGOs simply don't respect the rules and will simply go back to helping the traffickers. So very strong words from him, and also saying that his priority is to help the 5 million Italians who are living in poverty and not to help migrants.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in Beijing this week, his fourth visit in less than a year. The trip comes as Chinese and U.S. officials held a second day of trade talks and as Kim prepares for a second meeting with President Trump. Analysts say the visit is likely to be an opportunity for the two countries to discuss North Korea's plans for another meeting with Trump. When the two met for the first time last March, they agreed to communicate more with each other about domestic and international affairs. China's Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un held three summits last year before and after meetings with Trump and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Harry Kazianis is director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest in Washington, and he asks VOA, it's Ira Melman asks him about what might be the biggest reason for the North Korean leader's visit to Beijing.
One word, leverage. What Kim wants to do is he wants to show Donald Trump, but I also think the entire world, that he does have another option, that he does have, quote unquote, a new way, as he actually mentioned in his recent speech on New Year's Day, that he doesn't need the United States if negotiations either at a summit or just generally don't go well when talking about Kim's nuclear weapons program. What Kim wants to show is that he could go to China and have China invest in North Korea as opposed to the United States or South Korea or getting sanctions lifted, which is something China can do, because we have to remember 90% of North Korea's exports go through China. And it's actually China is the one who enforces the United States' maximum pressure policy. So for Kim, this is a very important visit.
How does this mesh in with the trade talks that are going along, which, by the way, have been extended for another day, we understand?
Well, I think for Xi Jinping, he wants to show Donald Trump that he has his very own North Korea card to play. I think what she wants to show the entire world is if those negotiations don't go well, he could very well unleash North Korea. And that could mean basically weakening the sanctions to such an extent that the maximum pressure policy is basically ancient history. So I think for Xi, he wants Donald Trump to know that he has leverage over him. And I think that's important. And I think that's why this summit is happening now.
In the past, China has at least verbally tried to separate politics and economics. You think they're still going to do that?
I don't think anymore. I think with the Chinese economy slowing down and Xi Jinping not really being able to, at least until this point, being able to make all of the structural changes that he wanted in the Chinese economy, I think he realizes that he needs to get every piece of leverage on the United States that he can. And I think that's why Kim is in Beijing right now. And I think it's also why that she is really trying to extend these talks, trying to get the best bargain he can. And I think eventually there will be a bargain here that's going to be hatched. I think both sides, Washington and Beijing, are both suffering from these trade talks, but it's, you know, we're going to have to see how it plays out. But I am optimistic.
How do you think the U.S. is handling this and should be handling it if they should be doing something else in your mind?
In terms of North Korea or China?
Let's try North Korea first, then we'll go to China.
Well, U.S. foreign policy when it comes to North Korea is very much a mixed bag at this point. I think nobody in the administration and no U.S. president wants to admit the obvious. North Korea is a bona fide nuclear power with at least 20 nuclear warheads that could probably kill millions of people around the world. But the United States continues to insist on a unilateral policy where North Korea would somehow give up all its nuclear weapons. I think anybody who's looked at this issue realizes that's probably not going to happen anytime soon, or it's months, years, maybe decades away. So I think for the Trump administration, they need to figure out a way where they can have a better relationship with North Korea, where North Korea does not test ICBMs and nuclear weapons anymore, and they craft some sort of long-term relationship to make sure that we never go back to the days of fire and fury in 2017. I do think that's something Kim wants as well, because he wants the sanctions lifted. So I do see a grand bargain that could be hatched here. But the question is, can the United States back off this unilateral policy where Kim gives up all his nuclear weapons before he gets sanctions removed? I'm not really sure, but I think that's where things stand with North Korea. In terms of China, I think for China, China is extremely concerned that the United States has adopted a policy of essentially containment, essentially what brought down the Soviet Union, you know, back in the late 1980s. And I think what they're trying to do is to show Donald Trump they do have a North Korea card to play, that they could unleash Kim if they really want to, and hopefully that'll get the United States to back off these very tough trade negotiations. And I think they will.
Well, that's your prediction there. What is your prediction for the immediate future as far as the U.S. and North Korea are concerned?
Well, I think there's going to be some tough times ahead. I do think there's going to be a summit, but I think if both sides are realistic with what can be accomplished, and I think they look to history as a guide, I think we have to remember things like the Cold War, better relations between, let's say, the United States and the Soviet Union, they didn't happen over one summit or two summits. It took multiple summits. It took years for, say, Reagan and Gorbachev to develop a better relationship. And any time you have an adversarial relationship between two countries that's gone on for decades, it's going to take time for that to get better. So I think for analysts and pundits on television who say, oh, this has been a failure, I'm not ready to call it a failure yet. I think if we're patient and I think both sides understand what it's going to take to reach a grand bargain, I think we can get there. But I think the only thing that's really going to fix this is time, but also trust built between both sides. And I don't think we have that trust yet. But I think if we have multiple summits, if the North Koreans will actually meet with U.S. officials in mid-level talks, which is something they haven't done yet, those are the people who would actually craft a bargain, I think we can get to a deal. But both sides have to be willing to compromise. That's the key.
That's Harry Kazianis, Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest in Washington, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Meanwhile, the U.S. and China will continue trade talks in Beijing for an unscheduled third day. A member of the U.S. delegation said on Tuesday, as the world's two largest economies look to resolve their bitter trade disputes. The UN Refugee Agency says a young Saudi woman who was about to be deported is in a safe place in Bangkok, Thailand, while her asylum request is being processed. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the Saudi teenager is no longer at the airport and is in a safe location in Bangkok. Rahal Mohammed Al-Kunan, who was in Bangkok on her way to Australia, had barricaded herself in her hotel room at the airport. She said she feared her family would kill her if Thai authorities deported her to Kuwait. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balosh tells VOA his colleagues in Bangkok are with her and took her to a safe place Monday.
We were quick to call on the Thai authorities not to deport her to a situation where she could be in danger and in risk. We have received assurances. Those assurances have been highlighted publicly by Thai authorities.
Balar says many refugees go through the kind of painful experience the Saudi teenager has been going through. He says he is glad this time the world is listening and reacting.
When you're fleeing for your life, trying to seek safety, and then you face so many hurdles in that journey, it must be distressing. That's why we are relieved that she's not anymore in that hotel room. She's at a safe place.
Balar says the UNHCR is assessing her asylum request. He says it is a routine procedure likely to take several days. Al-Kunan has said she would like to seek asylum in Australia, Canada, or Britain. An Australian Home Affairs official has said his government would carefully consider her request when the UNHCR process is complete. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. More than 4,000 exhibitors from 155 countries are in Las Vegas, Nevada this week for the Consumer Electronics Show, one of the year's biggest conventions for companies that want to show off their latest technology. Michelle Quinn got a look at some of the products that are hoping to make a splash.
Here at the Consumer Electronics Show, it seems that every activity can use a little help from technology.
And we are here at the CES to show a new product, which is the production for the bicycle.
More than 180,000 people are in town this week for the annual technology show. They come to see the latest from established big tech companies, but also from new ones. Hillite from France makes airbags with sensors as protection for risky activities.
Accelerometers, gyros, and then we have a microprocessor which is analyzing the motion of the cyclist. If I fall, the sensors will detect the fall and it will send a signal to the cartridge, which is located here, and the cartridge will inflate all the airbag, front, neck, and back.
Playing with the technology on the show floor is part of the fun. But some of the excitement at CES this year is about changes to come with the new speedy 5G mobile internet networks.
CES is actually a global platform for all technology products. You know, some of the key themes that we're seeing this year is things like 5G technology, which are going to enable so much faster communications for everything from healthcare to driverless car to AI. And
in the meantime, robots show off. They can do some human work. And sensors packed into everyday objects promise to make life better.
It's using sensors and an app. 20 minutes before the wake-up time is going to warm up smoothly to help you wake up.
And augmented reality can let you see the world and yourself in a new light.
You can try on 30 shades in 30 seconds on the app.
At CES, while the star of the show is technology, human ingenuity is also on display. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Las Vegas.
Saxophonist Tia Fuller was crying in bed and praising God. She just received the news that she's been nominated for her first ever Grammy Award. But it's not just any nomination. Her inclusion in the Best Jazz Instrumental Album category is a historic moment for women because they've rarely been nominated for the coveted award throughout the Grammy's 61-year history. And if Fuller wins, she becomes just the second woman to take home the prize. Her nominated album, Diamond Cut, is a smooth and striking collection that's brought the skilled performer who once played with Ray Charles during her college years and toured with Beyoncé to the next level. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.